headlines this hour. China accuses NATO of creating confrontation after a vow from the Western military alliance to counter what it calls the challenges posed by Beijing. The UN is under fire for improperly sharing data from more than 800,000 Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. And a bomb attack in a military training camp in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, leaves at least 15 army recruits dead. Well, welcome to our news studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. China has accused the Western military alliance, NATO, of artificially creating confrontations with Beijing. The Chinese mission to the European Union has urged NATO to stop exaggerating what it called a threat theory against Beijing. The mission says NATO's latest stance proves to be the continuation of a Cold War mentality. On Monday, NATO leaders vowed to work together to counter challenges posed by China. They accused the Asian powerhouse of threatening the international order through assertive actions, among other things. Tensions have mounted between China and the West in recent months for a range of issues, including human rights news. Independent China specialist Andrew Long says that China, as a rapidly growing economy, can overtake the U.S. in a matter of years.
China has been rising rapidly as an economy, and then according to various estimates, it could overtake the United States as the largest economy in the world as early as 2028. Because of this quicker recovery from the pandemic, overtaking the United States is expected to be 5 years earlier than previously expected. But there is also the concern that with China's growing influence, it could gather more friendly neighbors to undermine the dominance of the U.S.-led global order. And then eclipsing Americans' influence in the Asia-Pacific and elsewhere. So, and also the Biden administration is aware of the weakness of the previous Trump administration and trying to rally support from its allies in Europe and elsewhere, the so-called G7, and also using NATO as another kind of platform to withstand the spreading Chinese influence.
The U.S. aircraft carrier group has entered the South China Sea amid heightened tensions with China. The U.S. Navy said that the strike group is on what it called a routine mission. The Navy said that the warships will be conducting maritime security operations, including flight operations and strike exercises. The Washington frequently stages war games and deploys warships in the South China Sea, especially near Chinese islands. Beijing has repeatedly objected to the missions, saying that the U.S. seeks to stoke tensions at China's doorstep. A prominent rights group says the U.N. improperly collected data on more than 800,000 Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh and passed them to Myanmar. Human Rights Watch has said that the move by the U.N. refugee agency is contrary to its own policies and exposes Rohingya to further risk. The group urged the UNHCR to investigate the issue. The U.N. agency has been registering the Rohingya refugees in Bangladeshi camps since they fled a 2017 deadly crackdown in their homeland, Myanmar. The agency says the data was meant to provide the refugees with identity cards, but Human Rights Watch says the Rohingya were given consent forms they could not read to share their data with Myanmar. Many of the refugees have refused to return to Myanmar, fearing a repeat of the 2017 crackdown that the UN has called genocide. India has registered more than 60,400 new COVID cases in the past 24 hours. That is the lowest daily rate the country has logged since March 31. The new figure brings India's total caseload to over 29.5 million. The South Asian nation also reported over 2,700 new fatalities in the past 24 hours. Its overall deaths now stand above 377,000. COVID-19 surged in India in April and in May. That caused daily infections to reach their peak of more than 400,000 last month. Strict lockdowns and mass vaccine rollouts have helped contain the surge. The country now has the second largest caseload and the third highest death toll in the world. Tedros said Africa is the most vulnerable that needs vaccines the most. The WHO wants at least 70% of the world's population to be vaccinated based on what the WHO chief has said. 70% of the world's population vaccinated by next year's G7 is the goal that is trying to be obtained. Wealthy nations' reluctance to spread or suspend intellectual property protection has hampered the production of much-needed COVID vaccine.
What the G7, I think, should have done was develop a genuine global plan to vaccinate the world. It would cost, the IMF has worked out the cost of this, it would cost around $50 billion, could be paid over a period of years. That, by the way, is the deal of the century, because until the pandemic ends, everybody is going to face huge risks and potential problems. So these sporadic, small-scale, charitable handouts from rich countries to poor countries is not a serious plan. It will not bring the pandemic to an end.
Mark Lowcock stressed that G7 completely failed to show the necessary urgency with regard to the pandemic, adding that they still have a lot to do. And in terms of the kinds of things that they need to do, he said that these developed nations should have done more to provide vital supplies, such as oxygen ventilators and testing kits, to the countries that are going to wait longer for vaccines. Separately, the World Health Organization chief said the G7 nations need to do more to deal with the global COVID crisis. At least 15 army recruits have been killed in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. The victims lost their lives in a suicide bomb attack on a military training camp. Somali officials say the bomber was disguised among recruits lining up outside of the camp when the blast occurred. The attack was the deadliest hit Mogadishu in the past 18 months. No group or person has claimed responsibility as of yet. Similar attacks in the past have been blamed by the Al-Shabaab terrorist group. Its members have been trying to overthrow the Somali government for more than a decade. Palestinian factions have called for protests in the Gaza Strip and in the occupied West Bank on Tuesday over a planned march by Israeli settlers in eastern Jerusalem al-Quds. Hamas and Fatah movements have urged the Palestinians to flock to Jerusalem al-Quds' old city to counter the settlers' march. Hamas has warned of renewed hostilities if the event dubbed the March to the Flags goes ahead. Separately, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh has warned about dangerous repercussions of the march. The Israeli media say the regime has made preparations for a possible escalation in Gaza over the march, which was originally due to take place last Thursday, but was delayed. Let's cross on over talking about Ramallah and talk to our correspondent Mona Kondil about this. Mona, at this point, are we first of all sure that this march is going to take place? If you can tell us when and more details about it, if you can.
Well, first of all, the Israeli military deployed Iron Dome air defense batteries and increased its level of alert in Jerusalem al-Quds ahead of warnings from the Hamas movement if the Israeli Jerusalem flag march continued to tour in Jerusalem al-Quds with the same route, with no change. Because the Hamas movement has threatened the Israeli regime of the consequences that would take place. Now, this Jerusalem flag march was supposed to take place last month. However, the Israeli regime decided to cancel it, or at first to change the route of the march, and then it was cancelled because of the situation that was taking place and the Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip and the firing of the rockets from the Gaza into the occupied territories in 1948. Now, what's going on is that today the Israeli settlers have decided to continue with this flag march. It's supposed to start at 6:30 in the evening hours, local time, Jerusalem time. However, it's decided that thousands of Israeli settlers will not pass through the Damascus Gate, or Bab al-Amud, as we call it in Arabic. So they are not allowed to enter Bab al-Amud, the Damascus Gate, to enter this gate into the old town of Jerusalem al-Quds. However, they will pass only outside this area. There would be holding flags, celebrating. These acts would be provocative for the Palestinians. Up to the moment, Palestinians are calling for demonstrations and protests to take place in Jerusalem al-Quds at the same time of this Jerusalem flag march by the Israeli settlers. Experts are saying that this march take place, it would be a real challenge for the new Israeli coalition cabinet and the new Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, because the settlers were saying or were waiting for Bennett whether he would change completely the route of the march or even to cancel this march. So he's, of course, would be facing new challenges if the settlers really entered the old town of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, or whether the 2,500 Israeli police officers that were deployed in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, would be able to prevent thousands of Israeli settlers from entering the old town of Jerusalem, Al-Quds.
So just to get an idea about the geography here of where these settlers are going to go, or whoever it is that's going to participate in addition to the settlers in this march, it's not going to happen in that area like the Jarrah neighborhood, where it could be a provocation in some senses. If you can just review that a little bit more for us so we understand where this is taking place. I mean, isn't that a restriction that has been placed as to prevent any type of violence or any type of perhaps head-on encounters between the Palestinians and the settlers?
Well, for the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and Silwan neighborhood, these are Palestinian neighborhoods outside the old town of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, very close to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. However, the route of the settlers' Jerusalem flag march, they are supposed to march in the streets that are supposed to be in the western part of the city, not the eastern part of the city, where is supposed to be Palestinian areas and supposed to be the capital of the Palestinians, according to the previous agreements. Now, the route, every year the Israeli settlers march in the streets. They arrive at the Damascus Gate, Bab al-Amud, and there is a gate completely closed by the Israeli soldiers. However, during such marches, or when the Israeli forces want to allow the settlers to raid Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, then they open the gate of the Damascus Gate to allow them to enter to the Islamic section or the Islamic part of the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. But what's going on today is that the Israeli police has said it will not open the gate from the gate of the Damascus Gate, of course, Bab al-Amud, in order not to allow the settlers to enter the complex. At the same time, Palestinian demonstrators and Palestinian worshippers would be there at that place in order to prevent any raid by the settlers to the old city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, or even to entering the complex of the Al-Aqsa Mosque via the Damascus Gate.
Okay, so given what you have said, last question here. We understand that actually Hamas has fired some rockets onto the sea in preparation, perhaps, of what may happen later on. Does it matter to Hamas that these somewhat restrictions have been placed for the settlers in terms of where they're going to be doing their protest, or for them, that doesn't matter?
Well, the last time Hamas movement issued a warning that in case the Israeli police and the Israeli military didn't stop the raids to the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex and didn't withdraw from Bab al-Amud area, the Damascus Gate, then Hamas would be firing rockets from the Gaza Strip. This is exactly what happened. Today, Hamas is threatening the Israeli regime that in case it allows the Israeli settlers to enter the eastern part of the occupied Holy City, or even the complex of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, mainly through Bab al-Amud area, then it would be it had warned of the consequences that would come later. It didn't say clear that it will fire rockets. However, the Israeli military immediately deployed Iron Dome air defense batteries in fear that Hamas could fire any rockets from the Gaza Strip. But up till the moment, experts are saying that at the time, the Israeli new cabinet, Israeli prime minister, are trying to appease the settlers, especially that he's only being the prime minister for one day. But at the same time, he had given orders for the Israeli police to not to allow the settlers to raid that part of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Jerusalem Al-Quds. That's why we are speaking about 2,500 more Israeli forces and police officers have deployed in the streets of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, mainly around the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the in the old town of Al-Quds.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That's Mona Kandil, our correspondent there from Occupied Ramallah. I have a feeling we're going to be talking to her at some point later today when the march takes place. Thank you so much, Mona. Moving on, Rabbi David Feldman says the planned march by Israeli settlers in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds is an outrageous and provocative move that could spiral out yet another round of escalation.
This is truly outrageous. This is a march which is going to take place now, planned to take place, after these marches that did take place early May, just a couple of weeks ago, and we saw, unfortunately, what the outcome was of it. So many people were killed, so much casualties, so much bloodshed, so much misery because of these reckless marches of provocation to make this statement and to fight against the Palestinian neighbors. Unfortunately, when we're talking about a day of rage, this might be a month of rage, this might be a year of rage, this is already going on for decades. This is truly outrageous. And sadly, when this is being done by this settler movement, which they come out in this religious way and they try to present this radicalism, this extremism, this this terrible behavior, and they try to show this with a religious face, this is truly embarrassing to Jewish people.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for tuning in. It's bye-bye for now.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Two Blue Lines, directed by Tom Hayes. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him, we are also joined by Professor Jonathan Rosenhead from the London School of Economics. He is also vice chair of Free Speech on Israel, a non-Zionist Jewish organization that believes anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Now, filmed over 25 years, Two Blue Lines explores the impact of Israeli settlements on the Palestinians, from before the creation of Israel to the present day, and not afraid to explore correlations between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine, what emerges is a picture of a desperate social and political struggle punctuated by violence, segregation, and racism. By primarily featuring the narratives of Israelis whose positions run counter to Israel's official policy, this documentary also provides a portrait of the ongoing conflict not often depicted in the mainstream media.
Cannot come into an area where other people are living, establish a state, confiscate their lands, and expect to live in safety. And that's what happened. They came in, conquered, and confiscated.
In these camps of misery lived the scores of thousands whose native land was for centuries Palestine.
We took land that in the Bible maybe is ours, but it definitely wasn't empty. There are people living here. This is their land.
This is ours. In every
every sense of the word.
From a distance, this Jewish colony in Palestine looks as romantic as a Dutch picture. Close to, it's different. The guards are Jewish colonists armed with shotguns.
This is not fair. So remember where you come from. Wait.
It's immoral what they do with religion, to my mind. And it's not Jewish. It's un-Jewish.
This is the acid test. This is the reality test. All these values that we've held for all these generations.
If people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet.
There is a way leading from humanity through nationality to bestiality.
3 a.m. and the killing is going on. Imagine. United States paying for all this.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a controversial subject and isn't shy to portray Israel in a negative light, and even interviews Israelis themselves who are against Israel's policies against the Palestinians and their treatment. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I think it's a little bit patchwork and piecemeal, and that's in part because of the way that this film was produced over the course of 25 years. So there is a sense of a director sort of going back to material and just stitching it together where he can. I think it has moments of real power, and as you say, it does have this new perspective on these events, and I think one of the challenges this conflict has presented to filmmakers is to try and find fresh angles, fresh ways into the conflict that aren't just restating the same old positions time and time and again. And this does find two or three new angles into this conflict that I thought were particularly revealing.
And what are some of those angles, if you could
briefly mention? Well, I mean, getting Israelis to talk about this conflict, and particularly recruiting very calmly spoken, very sympathetic Israelis who have been given, at the very least, cause to doubt what their rulers have been doing over the past 50 years in particular, and often are openly critical of official state policy. It is obviously a very, very tricky subject, but here there is a sense of filmmaker really going a little bit deeper and finding out that there are little pockets of room to manoeuvre, room for negotiation.
It is refreshing to see. Indeed.
Yeah, very much so.
Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, it's very much not a neutral film. It is objective in that it describes quite calmly some very disturbing things. It represents, perhaps not quite proportionally, it represents the views of some of the settlers who are, if you like, the beneficiaries and the perpetrators of many of the wrongs. It does so in order to reveal the inconsistencies in their position and their assumptions, and some of which I think Jews would find extremely repugnant. But so that when one of the settlers says, oh, there's violence on both sides, I was shot at once, I was shot at in my car with a machine gun, and then he's asked later on, why do you live with your children in this dangerous area? He said, oh, it only happened to once. Mm. But for Palestinians, it happens every day, not actually being shot at, but they are subjugated, humiliated, prevented from going about their daily life, etc. And that is shown very vividly.
We do indeed get a spectrum of opinion and views on this documentary.
The whole world sees the immorality of our of what we're doing and of what we've been doing since we've been occupying the West Bank for 22 years. For two decades, the world didn't see it because the Palestinians seemed willing to live under Israeli rule. That is, they didn't revolt. The children who grew up in that period, seeing their parents bending their heads under Israeli occupation, said to themselves, when I grow up, I'm not going to put up with this. And so began the Intifada.
Can I just just want to address a point he made. Jonathan, he says that the Palestinians seemed willing, or the older generation, to live under Israeli rule. Surely that can't be right.
I was in Israel in 1956 as a visitor. I visited it not at all for the next 40 years. I don't know, I can't say from first hand what it was, but one can imagine the trauma of this total dispossession. 80% of the Palestinians were forced out. Those that were left often had their villages and their homes destroyed. So one can well imagine that it took time to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger generation, which grew up under those circumstances, was then more resilient and said, we don't want to live like this for the rest of our lives. Now, of course, the fact is they have had to live like that for the rest of their lives, and it's getting worse.
And definitely in this film you see this resurgence and this uprising, especially among the youth. And Mike, do you have any thoughts on what Jonathan just said and how the portrayal of the resistance is shown?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the advantages this film has is that it is shot over 25 years. So you do get a sense of not just how long this conflict is going on, but how positions are shifting, how people's perspectives are changing in the course of that quarter century. You know, I do think you get a sense that people are becoming more and more aware that actually for a long time the only way out of this conflict has been death. Mm-hmm. And I think people are starting to look for avenues, ways out, and to communicate their position in a way that isn't necessarily violent. Mm-hmm. And all that comes through in the course of the film.
Mm-hmm. Of course, in the documentary you also see lots of statistics. It was filmed over 25 years, many historical events that happened during that time. And I just want to touch on a few statistics that the documentary raises, particularly about Palestinian children fatalities in comparison to Israeli casualties. And you can see the difference is stark. So according to the documentary, child fatalities between 2000 and 2014 of Israeli children was something like 133, whereas over 1,400 Palestinian kids were killed by the Israeli side. Does this show then that this is indeed an unequal war?
It's not really a war at all, because it's not a war. A war, you have to have two sides. Here you have basically one side, which can punish the other side at will. Now, I think the suicide bombing was both immoral and it was counterproductive for the Palestinians. So I'm not trying to defend that. But it was a relatively short period when it was realized that it was actually reinforcing the tendencies to repression of the Israeli state. So that was cancelled, and I think that is completely right. But people in this country pay attention when Israel is attacking Gaza, and quite a lot of people would know that 2,000 people were killed, more than 2,000 were killed in the last assault in 2014. What they don't realize is that this happens on a small but regular scale every day of the week, and that the numbers killed of Palestinians now in excess of 10,000, so that the assaults on Gaza are less than half of the total of deaths, and that is the price of Israel repressing the Palestinians.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary then portrays the conflict as an unequal conflict, and serves as a good introduction to people who are unaware of what is happening?
Yes, certainly, because it is talking to people on the ground, it is talking to people who are caught up in this conflict, either on one side or the other, so it shows you the way the travel system has been converted in a particular way, so that Israelis are allowed to travel on certain roads, Palestinians aren't. Certain roads are blocked off, walled off. The level of control extends to something like the water supply, and there's a lot of talk in this film about some people are going without water, other people have enough water to fill a swimming pool.
The settlements have some, yes.
Yeah, exactly. What you get in the course of the film is a sense of the level of control that's being imposed over every single aspect of life. To see that is very stark.
It is far-reaching and multifaceted.
The minimum service that the municipality have to give to the people is to take the garbage, to collect the garbage. I don't talk about the roads. You can see the road. I don't talk about the lights. I don't talk about school services and water services. Even water, people, the municipality didn't give them. The municipality said
no bees at all. No bees.
There is no peace at all.
This is all done on purpose. Nothing of the occupation happens by chance. No, it happens on purpose. It happens in order to make the Palestinians' life a hell.
We have dehumanized the enemy, as we have been dehumanized only a short time ago. We call them Chayadu Aglit, a two-legged enemy. We are reenacting without being able to control it. We are reenacting what happened to us as if we've never learned anything.
Very powerful words there. Jonathan, I just wanted to get a quick reaction from you following from that clip of that woman, what she just said, and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine.
Yeah, so that in Britain, where we're speaking from, has become a big issue because there has been an attempt to police what you're allowed to say about Israel or Palestine. If you make any such comparison, there will be a whole gang of people on the phone to the papers or the government saying that this is anti-Semitism because you're drawing parallels. But of course we have to draw parallels with those events in history which speak to people. That's our way of making sense of what's happening now. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that it is the same, it's different, its scale is completely different. The intention is not to annihilate a whole race, but the intention is to demolish a nation, which is slightly different, with all its identifying characteristics, and to steal its land. And one has to be able to make those parallels, just as one makes the parallels with South African apartheid, mm-hmm. which is, I think, in this documentary, absolutely starkly evident that it's apartheid in Israel.
And Mike, we were just talking before we went to the clip, actually, about how this documentary portrays how Palestinians are being dehumanized in every aspect of this control system. What other scenes from the film struck out the most to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things this film did was introduce me to a number of the groups who are working within the Middle East to try and resolve this conflict peacefully. So, you know, groups like Blockade Watch and Peace Block. The women in black, who are, I think, wives and mothers and daughters, who are on the Israeli side, who come out to mourn the losses of all the children killed in the conflict. So there is a sense of people on the ground starting to realize the extent to which this conflict has cost them personally. And, you know, the scenes of mourning are very, very powerful.
And speaking of Israeli settlements, this documentary goes into detail about that and interviews settlers themselves, who we can see are quite vicious in their treatment to the Palestinians. Now, according to reports, around 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds, which is in violation of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. And this documentary does a good job of showing various UN resolutions that are being violated. Why then is the UN so powerless against Israel?
Oh, well, that's very clear. The UN is unable to pass resolutions which would have teeth, that is to say, which would impose sanctions on Israel without the agreement of all the powers with vetoes at the Security Council. And the United States has vetoed over 40 such resolutions over time. Often it's been the only country in the Security Council voting against the resolution. So it ensures that the so-called international community is absolutely toothless. And countries like Britain or the European Union regularly make statements, pass resolutions in Parliament saying, we deplore this, we don't like that. They do nothing because they are unwilling to separate themselves from this very strong United States position. So the whole international community mouths pious words, except perhaps the United States doesn't do it so much, and does nothing. And therefore it's up to the Palestinians themselves who have to endure, and the international civic society, which has to adopt boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Well, boycott is what we can do as individuals, as a means of supporting and putting pressure on the Israelis to come to the table and make the concessions necessary for peace.
This village cannot have electricity. You'll see there are electric wires that an NGO put in, but the Israeli military will not allow them to hook up to the electric grid. if you can imagine that kind of racism. I believe if people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet. You know, I've seen the most heinous crimes committed against Palestinians, and my Israeli friends would stand with me in saying the same thing.
The fact that there are Americans who are tolerating in Israel what they would not tolerate in the United States itself, and American Jews who accept that Israel behave in a way which they would very much object to people behaving in the United States itself, is very bad for Israel.
And Mike, what did you make of this part of the documentary? Was this another refreshing angle to see on this conflict?
Certainly. I mean, it's telling that actually the production company responsible is called Journeyman Films, because either this is the work of an American director, a veteran American director, probably wasn't quite as veteran as when he first started shooting all this, and than when he came out of it. But it is, I think, clearly the work of an American director possessed of a conscience enough to want to bring this conflict back home to America and to show the American people exactly what's going on in this particular part of the world. And it does a very good job of defining this very complex relationship between the US and Israel as we go into the final half hour of the film.
And Jonathan, this film confronts American viewers with a sort of Israeli schism over the country's oppression of Palestine, as well as the US government's responsibility. The documentary says that over $100 billion of taxpayers' money have been spent to Israel, the most than any other country in the world. And the majority of the Security Council vetoes have supported Israel's wars. Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call then to Western audiences?
But that very much depends on how widely it gets viewed. And there is a very elaborate and expensive and effective campaign run by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel to try and blanket the world with propaganda favorable to Israel. And we have, of course, our own domestic in Britain, Israel lobby, which was shown in a recent documentary. We have the very powerful Israel lobby in the United States. And the media is very nearly impermeable to these sorts of arguments generally. And that the campaign to persuade people that even relatively mild criticism of Israel is probably motivated by anti-Semitism started in Israel and has been pumped out around the world. And I think the reason is they don't want this message to get out. Now, whether this documentary can make it, I very much hope so. And if so, it will have a powerful effect.
Actually, a point you just made, the documentary mentions about the media and how the Israelis are always portrayed as the victims, whereas the Palestinians are the aggressors, when actually it's the reverse situation.
Yeah.
How responsible does the media, what role do they play in pushing this narrative?
Well, I think they are susceptible to it. And there is a battle going on about language, how you describe things. It's, as Alice said in Alice in Wonderland, it's when Alice says to Humpty Dumpty, you can't use that word, make it mean anything you like. And Humpty Dumpty says, the question is, who's to be master? That's all. Mm-hmm. And if you can control the language by which something is described, you control the perceptions. And I think that attempt is going on. We have to fight for the right to describe it as it is.
And Mike, would you agree with what Jonathan said? Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call also for Western audiences?
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, it's getting a pretty small distribution. It's being independently distributed online. It doesn't have necessarily the cinematic heft that we've seen films like Waltz with Bashir and The Gatekeepers, the documentary from a couple of years back, that were all about Israeli people talking about the failings of the Israeli authorities. So it doesn't quite have that cinematic heft. But, you know, if you can find it out, like I say, it does have some really powerful moments.
And if I could we're coming to the end of the programme now, if I could get your final thoughts on the documentary and if you'd recommend it.
Oh, it's certainly, you know, this situation is so tricky that, you know, any new perspective that people can find on it, it is worth seeking out for that reason.
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, can I get your final thoughts on the film also?
Very striking how little has changed except insofar it's intensified and got worse. You see the interviews and you're not sure necessarily whether it was done in 1989, 1999, 2009, This is a continuing story, and we have failed, and we have to do better.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of the show. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review. We'll be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, we're here with you with another episode of From the Moon to the Sun, on which we get to celebrate the splendid, glorious, joyous, celebratory, auspicious occasion, the 10-day period between the birth anniversary of Sayyidah Ma'asumah salamullah alayha and Imam Ridha alayhi salam. And this coincidence, I think, is one of the most joyous coincidence that could ever occur. The fact that these two brother, this two brother and sister are so close in bond, are so close in their heart, their essence, their soul, that even their birthdays are so close. And this is just my personal interpretation, but it just makes my heart throb a little to imagine how close they were and how much love and passion existed between them. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. My always full of energy friend, Zainab, how are you?
I'm well, welcome to the show.
Alhamdulillah.
And Eid Mubarak to you.
Thank you.
And to all our audiences, of course. So we've been talking about the different dimensions of the personality of Sayyidah Ma'asumah salamullah alayha, and we have to admit that we haven't talked about it enough.
Mm-hmm.
And our time on this show is fortunately or unfortunately so short that we really don't get to discuss it properly and really get into the depth of her personality. I think we need to write a few volumes of books to be able to do that.
Yeah.
But from one Muslim lady to another, I have to say that this is such a great privilege.
Yes.
Privilege is being the key word that we, you know, toss around in our discussion a lot, because to have such a role model in our lives,
right,
to be able to celebrate her in such a way, and to have the opportunity to share this information with other devotees, other lovers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, is nothing short of a privilege. So what do you have in store for us today in regard to Sayyidah Ma'asumah salamullah alayha?
I was talking to a friend of mine a couple of days ago, and I was asking her, I said, what do you want to get in your life? Where do you want to get? Like, you know,
your goal, your aim.
What's your goal in life? And she said, well, I want to, you know, I want to become such a chef, such an international chef in the world, and I want to do this and that. And I was thinking with myself that what has happened to us, to our lives, to our everyday lives, that for us, our role models have become someone's like a superstar, like a good teacher in university, like an international chef, and not our ma'asumin, and even... And that was a question that came to my mind. Why isn't it the case that I look up to Lady Fatimah al-Ma'asumah and I say she's my role model?
To be like her is my objective in life.
Exactly. If you go ask around many, even Muslim Shiite girls, would they say that they would consider Lady Fatimah al-Ma'asumah as a role model? I'm sure some would do, but again, a large number of them would not. As we said in the beginning of our programs in the previous episodes, that we have been living in a world where social status, where class, social class, and money, power, and prestige has become the standard, has become the criterion for our lives. And why have we distanced ourselves so much from people like Lady Fatimah al-Ma'asumah, who lived hard lives and short lives, but lived fruitful lives. And after so many years, 1,400 years, 1,200 years, we still look up to them and consider them as our role models. So when I delve a little, not very deep, when I delve a little into the life of Bibi Fatima al-Ma'suma, and I see her concerns in life, then it's a maybe it's a wake-up call for all of us, especially Muslim girls and women. As you know, in Iran, the birthday of Lady Fatima al-Ma'suma is called Daughter's Day, Girls' Days, because the birthday of the auspicious birthday of Lady Fatima al-Zahra is considered as Women's Day in Iran, and the auspicious birthday of Lady Fatima al-Ma'suma is Girls' Day in the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Shall we go for a break?
Sure.
We're going to go for a short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and this is From the Moon to the Sun. Our show is about the birth anniversary of Sayyidina Ma'suma Salamullah Alayha and Imam Rida Alayhi Salam, 10 days in between, and it is called the 10 Days of Kirama in many parts of the world. And we were talking about the different dimensions of the life and personality of Sayyidina Ma'suma Salamullah Alayha, and you were mentioning the fact that it is such a shame that we have such a treasure, such a valuable gem, such a jewel of a character in our ideology, in our teachings, but we've drifted so far away from the essence and the core of Islam, unfortunately, that we've neglected these characters, these personalities. And if we really take them as a role model, I think we won't necessarily become Fatimah al-Ma'suma herself, but to come close to that could really be the objective of our creation at the end of the day.
Just as you were talking, I remembered that one of the blessings of having Lady Fatimah al-Ma'suma in the city of Qom is the is that after she passed away, they built a tomb for her. It was a very simple tomb, but throughout the years it was built and rebuilt, and it was made into a very beautiful place that, like we had, I was reading last night that a lot of non-Muslims are attracted to the city because of the very nice architecture of the shrine of Lady Fatima al-Ma'suma, but still today, Sister Zainab, we have people, men and women, coming from other countries, coming from other cities, to the city of Qom to study in the seminaries of Qom. And this is one of the blessings, one of the barakat of the presence of Lady Fatima al-Ma'suma in the city of Qom. So we were talking about role models, that, you know, it's a shame that we haven't taken this pearl, this gem as our role models, but there are a lot of girls, young girls, that I know a lot of them who have left their families behind and their countries, and just like you, my dear sister, traveled all the way to Iran, to the city of Qom, to get to, you know more about the Ahlul Bayt, about the family of the Prophet. And so, and alhamdulillah, there is still hope, different rays of hope that you see people coming and people still valuing and treasuring the presence of such valuable personalities in history. So we were talking about the spiritual dimension of Lady Fatima al-Ma'suma, and we said that there are narrations from three imams signifying, emphasizing the spiritual aspect of the life of this lady. When I was going through the life of Fatimah al-Ma'suma and I was trying to have a better understanding of her life, the points that came to my life was that the different aspects of her life, first of all, the political aspect of her life that we said in our previous program. I just want to make a summary of our previous programs to have a generalistic understanding or grasp of what we have said. The political dimension of her life with regards to the understanding the position of Imamat, and to, they say that one of the reasons of her migrating and traveling, one of the reasons of journeying all the way from Medina to Marv, was to waken up the people and to teach them, to instill in them the love of the Ahlul Bayt. Because we have a lot of, we even had a lot of Shias or lovers of the Ahlul Bayt after Imam Ridha alayhi salam migrated, moved to the city of Medina. And one of the things that he constantly tried to say was to bring up the fact that I am the Imam of my time. Lady Ma'suma tried to do the same thing. She tried to strengthen this mentality in the minds of people that my brother is the next successor, is the next waliullah, the next guardian, the next one chosen by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to lead mankind to the truth. So the political dimension of her life is very bold, I find. Just like the political dimension of the life of Sayyida Zainab salamullah alayha in her journey all the way from Saudi Arabia after coming back from the pilgrimage of Hajj, going to the land of Karbala and then going to the Sham and all the different places, refreshing in the minds of people the position of Imamat. I cannot talk enough of the importance of Wilaya, of the Imamat, of the Imams, the chains that link us from the earth to the heaven. The other aspect of Lady Fatimah al-Masuma's life is with regards to her spiritual aspect, her nearness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. As we said in our previous program, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala not to deprive us of understanding her position. You read about her scientific dimension of her life. So someone who is rich in political understanding, someone who is rich in the spiritual dimension of her life, in the academic position, in the all this alongside having a very nice and warm family bond with her brother Imam Ridha alayhi salam and other members of her family, which constitute a perfect lady, a perfect Muslim lady that you can possibly see in history.
Thank you so much, Sister Razia. Thank you a lot for help us collect our mind with a center focus, a better focus on the personality of Sayyida Ma'suma salamullah alayha. And thank you to our audience for being with us throughout this journey from the sun to the moon. Be blessed. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.